This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related. Happy Valentine's Day! In keeping with Panina's founding principles, let's start with celebration before we move into weightier matters. With some historical background on this celebration of love, here is Ivy Cohn with a segment she originally produced last year at this time for Extinction Radio, used here with her permission.
The history of Valentine's Day is obscure and further clouded by various fanciful legends. The holiday's roots are in the ancient Roman festival of Lupercalia, a fertility celebration commemorated annually on February 15th. Pope Gelasius I recast this pagan festival as a Christian feast day in 496, declaring February 14th to be St. Valentine's Day. Which St. Valentine this early pope intended to honor remains a mystery. According to the Catholic Encyclopedia, there were at least three early Christian saints by that name. One was a priest in Rome, another a bishop in Terni, and of a third Saint Valentine almost nothing is known except that he met his end in Africa. Rather astonishingly, all three Valentines were said to have been martyred on February 14th. Most scholars believe that the Saint Valentine of the holiday was a priest who attracted the disfavor of Roman Emperor Claudius II around the year 270. At this stage, the factual ends and the mythic begins. According to one legend, Claudius II had prohibited marriage for young men, claiming that bachelors made better soldiers. Valentine continued to secretly perform marriage ceremonies, but was eventually apprehended by the Romans and put to death. Another legend has it that Valentine, imprisoned by Claudius, fell in love with the daughter of his jailer. Before he was executed, he allegedly sent her a letter signed, "From Your Valentine." Probably the most plausible story surrounding St. Valentine is one not focused on Eros, passionate love, but on Agape, Christian love. He was martyred for refusing to renounce his religion. It was not until the 14th century that this Christian feast day became definitively associated with love. According to UCLA medieval scholar Henry Ansgar Kelly, author of Chaucer and the Cult of St. Valentine, it was Chaucer who first linked St. Valentine's Day with romance. In 1381, Chaucer composed a poem in honor of the engagement between England's Richard II and Anne of Bohemia. As was the poetic tradition, Chaucer associated the occasion with a feast day. In Parliament of Fowls, the royal engagement, the mating season of birds, and St. Valentine's Day are linked. For this was on St. Valentine's Day when every fowl cometh there to choose his mate. Over the centuries, the holiday evolved, and by the 18th century, Gift-giving and exchanging handmade cards on Valentine's Day had become common in England. Handmade Valentine cards made of lace, ribbons, and featuring cupids and hearts eventually spread to the American colonies. The tradition of Valentine's cards did not become widespread in the United States, however, until the 1850s, when Esther A. Howland, a Mount Holyoke graduate and native of Worcester, Massachusetts, began mass-producing them. In 1969, the Catholic Church revised its liturgical calendar, removing the feast days of saints whose historical origins were questionable. Saint Valentine was one of the casualties. Today, of course, the holiday has become a booming commercial success. According to the Greeting Card Association, 25% of all cards sent each year are Valentines. I'm Ivy Cohn. Have a happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Ivy. That was entertaining and informative. I researched that Chaucer poem, but decided not to attempt a reading. It's 27 pages long. And I had no idea that St. Valentine's Day was initially a celebration of agape rather than eros. Hearing this, I am reminded that I wanted to share a comprehensive blog I found about the different kinds of love. It was written by Cheryl Paul for Sojourner, and republished in the Huffington Post, dated 4 July 2012. She opens with an excerpt from Robert A. Johnson's 1995 book, The Fisher King and the Handless Maiden. Quote, Sanskrit has 96 words for love. Ancient Persian has 80. Greek, 3. And English, only 1. This is indicative of the poverty of awareness or emphasis that we give to that tremendously important realm of feeling. Eskimos have 30 words for snow because it is a life and death matter to them to have exact information about the element they live with so intimately. An Eskimo probably would die of clumsiness if he had only one word for snow. We are close to dying of loneliness, because we have only one word for love. Of all the Western languages, English may be the most lacking when it comes to feeling. Close quote. So that set me off on a quest for those three Greek words, since Ivy only mentioned two, eros, or sexual passion, and agape, or love of God, or love of the all. The third is philia, or deep friendship, as in the name of the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the city of brotherly love, although, according to an article in the 27 December 2013 issue of Yes Magazine, the Greeks associated this kind of love not with siblings, but with brothers in arms. And with the insertion of the aut, or aut, syllable, we get philautia, or self-love, for we can only love another to the extent to which we love ourselves. And then there is ludus, or playful love, such as in flirtation with a prospective lover, or the love between young playmates. And at the other end of that spectrum is the very serious pragma, or long-standing love, such as that between couples who measure their relationship in decades, where I think I recognize the root of the word pragmatic. Returning to Cheryl Paul's article, she lists some of the plethora of feelings she can recognize even under the perhaps too big umbrella of what we call romantic love. Quote, when you break it down, you see that there are so many ways to love your partner. There's the appreciation you feel when he does something thoughtful and kind, like brush the snow off your car in 20-degree weather or buy your favorite kind of bread. There's the comfort you feel when you come home at the end of a hard day at work and she's there, waiting for you with a plate of hot food and your favorite TV show queued up. There's the gratitude you feel when she attends the 12th family gathering of the year. There's the warmth you feel when you see him across the room and know that he's your guy. There are the tingles you feel when she kisses you, maybe not every time, but enough to know that a spark still burns between you. There's the trust you feel when you walk through a difficult conflict together and emerge stronger than ever on the other side. There's the awe that you feel when you remember how rare it is to find someone who gets you and who you get. There's the softness you feel when you focus on one physical quality in your partner that melts your heart and brings a smile to your face. There's the joy you feel when you listen to your favorite song together or have a blast on the dance floor. There's the contentment you feel when you read together but separately before going to bed. There's the stability that grows when you nurture the garden of your marriage year after year, enduring challenges and celebrating joys, and always knowing that you support your own and each other's growth and happiness. When we attune our awareness and widen our consciousness to include these variations on our narrow cultural definition, we know that romantic love is infinitely richer than the images presented on the big screen, infinitely more nuanced and alive than the one-dimensional feeling of butterflies that sometimes initiates a relationship. It's appreciation, comfort, gratitude, warmth, tingles, trust, awe, softness, joy, contentment, and stability, to name just a few words for love. When we commit to loving one person with whom we can learn about it, it becomes one of the most fulfilling and meaningful paths we can embark upon. Close quote. On the other hand, some people don't believe it's realistic to expect one person to provide oneself with all of these flavors of love, or to be the provider of them all to that person. So here's John Cossum to explain about polyamory. Poly, more than one. Amory, love.
Ah, thank you, Susan. So today we're exploring love, because it's Valentine's Day. Now, I feel quite well qualified to talk about love, as I've experienced a tremendous lot of it in my 50 years, and luckily for me, I have the most wonderful love life. I believe this is primarily because I'm polyamorous. Here is what polyamory is and isn't. Polyamory can be defined as honest non-monogamy, or having romantic love for more than one person. It isn't cheating, although polyamorous people can cheat. It isn't promiscuity, although polyamorous people may be having more sex than most monogamous people. In fact, it's nothing to do with sex, really, as there are asexual polyamorous people. And I have one polyamorous partner with whom I don't have sex, although we do love each other dearly, and we probably would be sexual if I wasn't married, as this partner believes in the sanctity of marriage, and like my wife, is more on the monogamous end of the spectrum. But unlike my wife, she needs her sexual partner to be monogamous with her. This doesn't stop us being very lovey-dovey and romantic and sharing a lot of very personal emotions and feelings. My situation is that I had a few years' attempt at monogamy at the age of 20, but a few years into that relationship, I cheated, and I found that both liberating and exciting, but also shameful and wrong, as I disliked lying. That relationship failed, and soon I was in a primary relationship with the woman who was to become my wife, and several other women who all knew about each other. My wife often meets my other partners, and usually gets on with them, and asks how they are. Just under 10 years ago, I joined the biggest British Facebook group for polyamorous people, and I've been the main admin for many years. So I'm lucky enough to learn a huge amount about how polyamorous people live. But enough about me. I wanted to explore why polyamory is becoming more popular and why it might be part of a fairer and happier society. And although it might sound like I'm criticising monogamy, I do respect those people whose relationship orientation is to have a relationship with just one person at a time, or rarely these days, to pair up with the first suitable person and have a lifelong exclusive relationship with them. This idea of the one, portrayed widely in popular culture, is pretty toxic. How many people feel as if they're a failure when their previously close relationship drifts apart? How confusing and disappointing must it be when you find the love of your life and then things fall apart, only to have another intense and passionate love affair and expecting this to be it? Many of our films, literature and music perpetuate the boy meets girl, boy marries girl, she has children, and they all live happily ever after fairy tale. How realistic is this? A more enlightened approach is to recognise that love comes and goes, overlaps and is different with different partners. I once had a partner I described as my intellectual girlfriend, as we had great intense conversations about feminism and politics. I don't have this sort of conversation with my wife, but that's okay. I love her qualities and her strengths. Polyamorous people don't believe one person can fulfill every need, and having more than one lover makes for a much richer and more varied life. Another idea that polyamory challenges is the concept of ownership and control. Marriage is steeped in issues of property inheritance and the patriarchy. One current indication of this is that the woman traditionally takes her husband's name. She becomes his. Female sexuality has traditionally been controlled by the model that women desire monogamy, and the penalties for female non-monogamy have been high. This norm ensures that the offspring's father is known and the family line is ensured. Polygamous marriages are most common between one man and more than one woman, although polyandry does exist in a few cultures. Polyamory challenges all this. Polyamory exists in many shapes. There are closed poly triads and quads. There are open polycules, or networks of romantically entwined people, both straight and gay, bisexual, pansexual, and asexual. Our community is very welcoming to transgender, agender, and gender fluid people. There are people who identify as solo poly, who may not have a primary or secondary partner, but may be involved with various people on their own terms, maybe refusing to pigeonhole what sort of relationship it is. An extension of this is relationship anarchy. Polyamory may even help challenge the idea that romantic love has to include sexual intercourse. Despite it being well known that many long-term monogamous couples have stopped having sex, maybe if they opened up their relationships, as many are doing, a new erotic element might brighten up their lives. There is a significant overlap between the poly community and the kink community, where people explore role play, domination and submission, and other consensual fun. The thing that connects all polyamorous people is the deliberate and radical honesty amongst all concerned. We're most often very emotionally literate. We understand how different relationships work, how insecurities can cause jealousy, and we sometimes experience the opposite of jealousy, a joyous feeling we call compersion. We get used to negotiating, to listening, to identifying our needs and being able to explain them. There are many polyamorous families who are bringing up children in a situation closer to an extended family rather than the nuclear family or single parent struggling on her own. Children cope very well with having more adults around and have more role models to draw from. I'm not anti-marriage, as I'm happily married, but I most certainly don't ever tell my wife what to do or have expectations of her. I'm not anti-monogamy. If that relationship orientation works for them, great. I hope monogamous people can have a similar respect for my honest non-monogamy. I love it that nowadays same-sex couples can live together or get married and be accepted by most intelligent people as just two people who love each other. And I want this too for people who happen to be able to love more than one other. It seems like a sensible progression in society, and it certainly increases the amount of love, commitment, and connection all of which we do need more of. I'm John Cossum, speaking for Sequitur on Panina. Happy St. Valentine's Day.
Thank you, John Cossum. How I wish I had had access to the kind of support your Facebook group is providing for people who want to step out of the puritanical box our Western European ancestors put us into, and both experience and express the full gamut of this rich emotion called love. There's another kind of love to which Lisa White alluded in her segment for Sequitur Paradox, but I think she spoke of it more in terms of our shadow self. I'm referring here to the love of our enemy. Say what? That's right. The Christian Bible says in Matthew 5:43, quote, "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you."
You know, was it worth it? A life without examination isn't worth it, Socrates citation. But I'm not persuaded it gets much upgraded by closer investigation. Hee-haw.
I don't know, Benji. Our brother and sister water protectors pray for the militarized police, who shoot them with rubber bullets and spray them with water hoses in sub-zero temperatures. There's an entire learning unit in nonviolent communication dedicated to overcoming enemy images, to which I want to return for a future feature. But for this time, I want to look at the life-serving purpose of having enemies, having significant others in our life on whom to project elements of our shadow self.
You know what you should do? Don't give folks advice in brochures which insist on your personal cures. We all, it's cliche, must find our own way, and the best way for them isn't yours. Hee-haw!
Okay, Benji, no advice, no brochures. I met Cheryl McCormick 6 or 7 years ago when we were both members of the Consciousness Transformation Community. She is a social entrepreneur with a coaching practice she calls Fearless Conversations. I apologize in advance for the poor audio quality of this segment, but it's the best we could do on short notice with Panina's free conference calling platform. When Cheryl is finished, we'll hear the same message in music with Marka Cassidy's song, Enemy.
Thank you, Susan, for having me on your show today. I'm delighted to have a conversation with you and get reconnected. And thank you for picking up on my newsletter. This is a short article that I wrote. I called it Out of the Shadow. It's something that I wanted to write in view of my business, Fearless Conversations. And it's hard to write, but here it goes. One of the challenges of Fearless Conversations is the stuff in us that we don't know much about, but it's there. And sometimes shows up whether it's welcome or not. There are different ways to talk about this stuff, but let's just say that it's parts of us that are less conscious. We say they are in shadow. We have a sense of this shadow experience. It can feel strange, awkward, clumsy, startling, intrusive, wrenching, rough around the edges. When we are having a shadow experience, it is common to feel reactive, even explosive. We can feel shocked, off guard, out of our comfort zone, in the grip of an unfamiliar force. This shadow stuff wants to be seen and heard. It bears both gifts and challenges to help us become the person or the people we can be. This is true of ourselves as individuals, our organizations, our workplaces, our relationships, our communities, our country, our world. It's as if the shadow parts say, "Listen, don't be afraid. We're here to awaken something good in you." They give us a kind of wake-up call. An example of a shadow experience, as I'm referring to it, is a disruption in a relationship that leaves us confused, defensive, lost. A friend, a spouse, a partner, a colleague, a family member does something or says something that beckons for a response. But for whatever reason, we find that what usually works for us doesn't. It's as if we're dislodged from the sense of ourselves that we count on, and we don't know how to get anchored again. Then we get into a tailspin of judgment about ourselves and the other person. We get out of the tailspin by stopping to pay attention to and honor what really matters to ourselves and to the other person. We replace judgment with empathy. Even if the relationship isn't healed, we get in touch with something in ourselves that helps us be more whole. As a country, we are having a highly charged shadow experience. We are out of our comfort zone. Even personal relationships are being affected. We have been dislodged from the sense of ourselves that we have counted on and trusted. It doesn't matter anymore what side we are on or how we voted in the election. Something has come out of our shadow that demands attention from all of us as human beings, as citizens of the world, not as Republicans, Democrats, pro this or that, anti this or that, neoliberals, conservatives, or whatever labels we put on ourselves and other people. Our shadow experience is asking us to dig deeper than ever to find and create ways to talk to one another and to work together to solve urgent, practical problems that affect all of us. Sometimes we feel up to having fearless conversations, sometimes not. Fearless conversations take energy, and sometimes we don't have the energy if we are afraid, angry, tired of it all, despairing, vulnerable, overwhelmed with grief. If we take time for compassion and empathy for ourselves and others, we can begin to regain trust, support, courage in talking with one another. We can find ways for everyone to know their needs matter. We can regain a sense of who we are and want to be as a country.
I could go on with this conversation. I would love to explore with you the relationship between anger and fear. You danced around it a few times there, talking about the impact that all of this cultural shadow work is having on personal relationships. Tell us again how we can get in touch with you and learn more about how to have fearless conversations in our life and our work.
Well, I have a website, fearlessconversations.org, and I really have been trying to emphasize simplicity around gathering people for the simple art of conversation, to talk with one another. And if we can do it in a safe way and do it with some sense of trust of one another, we can do it without fear. And I want to encourage people to go with the fear. Let the fear be an indicator of something to follow and let it tell you what it has to tell you in terms of something that wants to be seen and heard, and let it be a messenger rather than a detractor.
Thank you for that. Go with the fear.
Go with the fear, absolutely.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, that's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
I take a deep, dark breath of my fear. Breathe out compassion to myself. I take a deep, dark breath of your fear. breathe out compassion to you. And the next breath is for all the people who can relate to me and you. You cannot see eye to eye, won't you step up with me and try? Drop the fences down, find the common ground, take a deep breath.
Forgiveness brings evolution.
enemy mine, reveal me. So we don't want to overcome those enemy images until we have gleaned the gifts they bring. This is essential feedback to show us our blind spots, whether personal or cultural. And even having blind spots is a gift, for it motivates us to connect like the interdependent beings that we are. You heard Marka Cassidy singing her song Enemy. You can find more of her music at Bandcamp. Now I have another voice from across the pond, another voice who likes to speak in poetry.
Hi, it's Deborah Kale Earnshaw here with my poem this week. It's called A Blackbird Singing, and it's by R.S. Thomas. It seems wrong that out of this bird, black, bold, a suggestion of dark places about it, there yet should come such rich music, as though the notes or were changed to a rare metal at one touch of that bright bill. You have heard it often, alone at your desk, in a green April, your mind drawn away from its work by sweet disturbance of the mild evening outside your room. A slow singer, but loading each phrase with history's overtones, love, joy, and grief learned by his dark tribe in other orchards and passed on instinctively as they are now, but fresh always with new tears, new tears, new tears, new tears, new tears.
You know, everyone's cranky lately, taking sides and more quick to condemn, feeling grouchy and starting mayhem, as others bring forces to take our resources, more and more of us turn into them. Hee-haw!
Yes, I've noticed how hard it is to walk my talk about finding the gift and overcoming my enemy images. For example, when Big Oil appropriates right-of-way under the water supply of the Standing Rock Sioux with their high-impact exploitation of habitat for extraction of obsolete resources freely given by our Mother Gaia, when they put true resources like water at risk for the sake of the economy of scale they require to satisfy their promises to their stockholders, when they continue to break hard-won promises to the people who are affected and treated like so much collateral damage or impediments to efficiency. But even the best trained practitioner of nonviolence has her breaking point. How I would love to have a scapegoat to scream at, and worse. I keep thinking I've prayed all my prayers, cast all my spells, cried all my tears, and yet, as we just heard, there are always new tears. So, as much as I hate to piggyback on a love fest to give you yet another tragic update, I respect your resilience too much to sugarcoat my current events report. In honor of Black History Month, I'll introduce my current events summary with the words of Frederick Douglass that I picked up just this morning from longtime Wise Virginia activist colleague Kathy Selvage's Facebook timeline. Quote, "At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could I reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced." End quote. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery in early 1818. He celebrated his birth on St. Valentine's Day, since slave births were not documented at that time. He died of natural causes at the age of 77, 55 years to the day before I was born. The crime against the nation that earned Douglas the harshest punishment as a young teenager was spreading literacy, and therefore insurgency, among his fellow slaves. The crime against the corporatocracy that is earning the water protectors the harshest punishment is the exercise of their so-called rights, freedom of speech and religion as guaranteed in the obsolete U.S. Constitution, which former President George W. Bush rightly claimed is no better than a piece of toilet paper, and property rights guaranteed by internationally binding treaties that are also not worth the paper on which they are written. The crime against the people is the complete disregard for their toothless rule of law, which could never be expected to have any more integrity than those who are charged with its enforcement. After 8 years of collusion with business as usual, these issues have suddenly been thrust into the limelight as the darling of the contrarian corporate media in their effort to spotlight the depravity of our new chief executioner. Oh, I mean chief executive. So, because I trust that you, dear listeners, are already following reports from those sources, I will report from less opportunistic sources. Alternative Media Syndicate reported on 6 February that the comment period preliminary to the environmental impact study we discussed in Sequitur Paradox was launched with militarized raids conducted by a multitude of forces: ACE, which is the Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Bureau of Fish and Wildlife, ATF, which is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and tribal police, as well as the Bureau of Indian Affairs forces, who reportedly entered the camp to check for flooding. Say what? Apparently, news of the executive order to bypass the EIS and fast-track the completion of DAPL along its hotly contested route under Lake Oahe has sparked a new wave of civil disobedience. There were 76 arrests last Wednesday alone. According to the StandingRockFactChecker.org blog, the total arrests had surpassed 600 by 18 January. This in turn has sparked a second mobilization of military veterans to defend the water protectors on the ground. Anthony Diggs, a spokesman for Veterans Stand, a continuation of the original veterans movement that deployed in December, said, quote, "We are committed to the people of Standing Rock. We are committed to nonviolence, and we will do everything within our power to ensure that the environment and human life are respected. That pipeline will not get completed. Not on our watch." Close quote. Veterans Stand has reactivated their GoFundMe campaign to support, quote, "a larger, solid, boots-on-the-ground presence," unquote, fortification against sub-zero winter temperatures, and to ensure, quote, "basic transport of supplies and personnel," unquote, CBS reports. Sam Levin, reporting from Standing Rock in today's UK Guardian, says that it is not known how many vets will arrive in the coming weeks. Some organizers estimate a few dozen are already on their way, while others say that hundreds could show up in the coming weeks. But despite the tribal council having sent everyone home back in December, Indigenous leaders have put out a call for water protectors, veterans or otherwise, to come to Standing Rock on the condition that they are well prepared physically for the harsh living conditions and morally and emotionally committed to nonviolence. Meanwhile, coming soon to your home state, stand warned. Legislation has been introduced or is being drafted in 5 states to reclassify arrestable actions to carry harsher penalties and to further protect corporate interests. North Dakota, clearly in response to Standing Rock, would provide exoneration for a vehicle operator who runs over a marcher even if the marcher's death ensues. Washington, clearly in response to a Black Lives Matter demonstration successfully blocking a highway, seems to be where the felony charge of economic terrorism originated. Minnesota provides for a full year of imprisonment for the crime of making wage slaves late for work. A separate statute already on the books provides for a minimum sentence of a year in prison, even for nonviolent obstruction, such as refusing an order to disperse or filming an arrest, according to a civil rights attorney in Minneapolis. Michigan apparently targets labor organizers and provides for individuals on a picket line to be singled out for prosecution. It was thankfully set aside by the state Senate. The Iowa legislation is still in early draft stages. I wonder if those of us who move our money or engage in tax resistance or rally on ACE grounds in our communities will be found guilty of economic terrorism. Or, for that matter, I wonder if employees such as earth-moving equipment operators or sheriff's deputies who experience that magical shift of consciousness and refuse orders that violate their conscience or even walk off their jobs, as suggested by Arundhati Roy's three-step grassroots nonviolent activist formula, boycott, divest, walk out, will be subject to felony prosecution as terrorists. As implied by the Frederick Douglass quote I read a few moments ago, perhaps the time for peaceful, prayerful protest has passed. Our military veterans do not have training in peaceful, prayerful protest. Our tax dollars have provided them with intensive training as lean, mean fighting machines. And nonviolent intentions notwithstanding, we all have our breaking points. I'm not the orator Douglass was. I tend to prefer sound bites, at least when I'm not off on a rant. One that I particularly like was the title of a Counterpunch feature from 8 February, The Violence of Silence. It's an interesting read since it covers the so-called Women's March of 21 January. Hardly a silent action by neoliberal standards. Returning for a moment to the rule of law, in spite of fears of chaotic collapse in its absence, can it be worse than its arbitrary application? A lot of good it did to have legislation requiring environmental impact studies and due process for stakeholders, right? And yet you know the corporatocracy hasn't a leg to stand on without the rule of law, as evidenced by the above-mentioned so-called opposition laws that are being crafted to suppress the grassroots. Another example of such tactics is taking place in the Cordillera del Cóndor in Ecuador, where a fine new constitution guarantees recognition to Pachamama, or Mother Earth, as a living being, and rights of sovereignty and self-determination to the Shuar and other indigenous people who have cared for her since before Ecuador existed as a nation-state. The Shuar successfully resisted the Spanish conquistadors, but the Rafael Correa government has deployed military tanks and helicopters to evict the indigenous villages. Explore Cobres S.A., or EXA, the corporation that the Chinese acquired from the Canadians, must be offering a big pile of money for mineral rights in the region, for they have augmented the troops with mercenaries to clear the area of the beings, human and otherwise, that stand between them and the intimate recesses of the body of the earth. They would clear-cut the rainforest that provides every second breath you and I take, and they would drain or reroute the waterways that provide the indigenous people with their livelihoods and their sustenance while building a massive hydraulic dam elsewhere that would transform inhabitants of this millennial homeland into refugees. Sound familiar? Water is life. The planned open-cut copper mine would make an estimated $1.2 billion in annual royalties for the Ecuadorian government. It would also consume 41,769 hectares of rainforest and rural agricultural land, much of it belonging to the Shuar peoples. Indigenous resistance resulted in Korea declaring a state of emergency, thus suspending basic rights such as freedom of assembly, freedom of movement, and due process under law, as well as granting the military so-called exceptional power to enter private residences and arbitrarily detain people without warrants or evidence. An overwhelming military presence was then deployed across the Amazonian province to bolster security around the Chinese mine and quell all dissent. Domingo Ancuash, the tribal leader of the Shuar, called upon the United Nations and other international human rights organizations to monitor the militarization of his people's ancestral lands, in which he estimates 8,000 high-ranking members of the military, as well as 4 war tanks, surveillance drones, aerostatic balloons, mobile satellites, and helicopter gunships have been deployed. In October, an entire village was forcefully evicted to make way for a mining camp. In December, a Shuar attempt to reclaim that territory left one police officer dead and others wounded. Authorities invoked their exceptional power to arrest Shuar Federation leader Augustine Wachapa in the middle of the night a week or so later. According to his wife, there was no warrant, and he was brutally thrown to the ground and stamped on and ridiculed in her presence. Officers then ransacked the Shuar Federation office and confiscated computers. Wachapa is being held in maximum security despite attempted intervention by Amnesty International, and the state of emergency has been extended, including a media blackout. For further historical background on resistance to the multinational mining industry in the Amazon, including accounts of the torture and extrajudicial killing of Shuar leaders, Google El Mirador. George Herrera, president of the Confederation of 14 Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, has expressed his increasing alarm at the military buildup inside of the Cordillera del Condor. He said, quote, "The military is not defending the security of the population, but rather the transnational corporations that have purchased licenses to exploit large hectares of Ecuadorian territory as private property," end quote. Ecuador will elect a new president next Sunday. President Correa has spent unprecedented sums of money on infrastructure projects and social programs on his ambitious socialist agenda, but a perfect storm of plummeting oil prices, economic mismanagement, and numerous corruption scandals have almost bankrupted the country and exposed his so-called citizens' revolt as the militarized neoliberalism that it is. It took multiple billion-dollar loans from China to artificially prop up the Ecuadorian economy. Is it any wonder China would have such enormous leverage on Ecuador's federal government, regardless of the political proclivities of whoever is in power? If you have any further questions about the power of money over arguably the poorest nation-state on Heart Island, check out The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. I save the best for last. An honest-to-goodness success story about protection of a rainforest on the other side of the planet, this one home to the orang-utan, or orangutan, which translates literally to the forest people. The habitat of this critically endangered great ape is now incorporated into the Kuamut Forest Reserve and safeguards the last vulnerable flank of the pristine forest of the world-renowned Donnam Valley Conservation Area. On 18 January, a major logging concession of 34,414 acres in the state of Sabah on the Malaysian portion of the island of Borneo was overturned and the land permanently protected through its designation as a forest reserve. Rainforest Trust CEO Dr. Paul Salaman said, quote, It was predicted that without intervention, 40% of the Kuamut forests would have been converted to sterile oil palm plantations by 2020. End quote. The region is also home to the critically endangered scaly anteater and a total of 15,000 flowering plant species, 220 species of terrestrial mammals, and 420 species of birds. Well, that's it for this time. I'll try to get back to you soon. There's much more I would share that just couldn't fit within my self-imposed runtime constraints. So for now, hugs and gratitude to Ivy Cohn and John Compost Cossum for help with the St. Valentine's observance, to Cheryl McCormick for her essay Out of the Shadow, to Deba Cale Earnshaw and Benjamin the Donkey for their poetic transitions between segments of the show, to Marka Cassidy for the song Enemy, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.